All right. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Drexel podcast. We'll go through, another good week. I don't think there are any postponements or cancellations. So that's good. We're on a nice streak. Hopefully we keep that going. But we have Brian Moll with us here tonight. I'll let him introduce himself in a second. But I did want to start out because I don't think I've ever met you personally, but really cool to be able to talk to you a little bit and learn from you. My background is, of course, from Pennsylvania and in Philadelphia, originally from the Allentown area, and then went to school at Drexel in Philly and lived there. But then was in the Navy at Camp Lejeune. That's where I did my residency. And the UNC Wilmington was like kind of my home away from home. We went to a lot of the games. And there's only three sports writers in my life that I've gone out of my way to read consistently. One of them is Keith Groller with the Allentown Morning Call. The second one is David Jones with the Harrisburg Patriot News. And the third one is you. I always tried to make sure I read your articles and things. Not that my opinion means that much, but I always wrote your write-ups on the games we went to and we didn't go to. So it's really cool to have you on. But interested to hear about you and you and your even what you're up to and everything like that. So if you want to tell us a little about yourself, and then we'll go from there.
Well, first of all, thanks for the very kind words. I appreciate that. And my name is Brian Moll. I'm a college basketball writer focusing primarily on the mid-major conferences in the eastern half of the country. Contributed to a number of places through the last couple of decades. Was the beat writer for UNC Wilmington for 7 years and primarily write for collegeinsider.com and help them with a lot of various things behind the scenes that they do, and also write some columns for them now and try to watch as many games as I possibly can and just talk to coaches and stay abreast of what's going on.
Go ahead, Nate.
Wait, and I think there was a comment, Dan says something about your caddy now with golf. So just tell us about that a little bit.
I do have a background. I caddied on the PGA Tour from full-time from 1996 to 2002, and then have sporadically gone out here and there since then. But I have two daughters at home that are keeping me pretty busy these days, so not very often. I have a friend who's I've known since childhood who just turned 50 who's trying to get on the Champions Tour. So I've caddied for him in a couple of qualifiers, but that's about the extent of it at this point. That possibility is always there, but that's pretty much my writing background and my life have been golf and college basketball. So I feel pretty fortunate.
I will say that the golf end of things, I didn't pay too close attention. Like Modern Rock 98.7 is still one of my favorite stations. And we listen to it up here. And I think Sunday mornings they go to our golf coverage, and fortunately I move away, but no, love all your basketball stuff. And so Dan, you're take it away there. I mean, what direction you want to go? Go for it.
Man, I thought I was a Brian Moll fan, and then Nate showed up a podcast. Brian's got the fortune of helping get in print my only application for a professional job for in a college athletics department when I applied to be with a number of other Drexel fans who probably are the only people listening to this podcast. I appreciate it. For a number of other Drexel fans, we applied for the UNC Wilmington AD position back in the day when they were going through some tougher times. And it's good to see, I think, Brian, that the picture may not be the rosiest right now across the board, and we'll talk about that. Actually, I think the realignment discussion, particularly at UNCW, is interesting right now. It seems like they have some stability a little bit down there. Is that about right?
Yeah, that is. That's a great point. After years of turnover and controversy within the department, a number of chancellors, athletic directors, of course, men's basketball coaches, only CAA school to dismiss two coaches mid-season in the last decade, which just is a reflection on how much the fan base and the folks care down here. It's been an interesting program over the last two decades. They've basically either been in the cellar or near the cellar or been a championship level team. They've won six championships since 2000, but have had probably 8 or 9 years where they were, in the play-in game or the early rounds of the CAA tournament and sent home. So obviously a lot of excitement down here, a fan base that will support the team. It's the only game in town, and a great environment to watch college basketball. And we've seen that here in the last couple of weeks with them back home, after, you know, on this winning streak.
You know, it's funny you say it because it resonates with a Drexel fan who watched Bruiser Flint for 15 years, always kind of get close but not get there, right? And it's very different, right? UNCW is kind of all or nothing. And because, you know, when anything less than the championship was kind of nothing, and it became nothing quick, and it was moved to the next guy. You know, Brew was stability, and he was solid. Drexel never made it to that dance. And you know, eventually, unfortunately, those mid-teen years here, this, you know, in 2015, 2016, just, you know, it went south quick. And at that point, it was an easy call. But a lot of the discussion in the fan base for Drexel in those years was, you know, do you want to be the team that's consistently there, but, you know, the bridesmaid, but not the bride? Or, you know, or do you want to try for something better, knowing that the risk is the opposite? You know, and I think at the end of the day, they held on for long enough that the decision was made for them, and that, you know, it was going to take some digging out. And I think we're going to have some discussion about Zach Spiker after this weekend, you know, and the game particularly on Saturday. But he took over something that wasn't great, and you know, they got a ring. The flags are going to fly forever. So it's an interesting, I think it's one of the better sports fan discussions and stories. And it's, you see two franchises there, two colleges there doing it entirely differently. And Brian, I think you're correct in that being the only game in town and having the passionate supporters that UNCW has is a big driving force of the difference. You know, Drexel's fan base, for what it is, well, loyal and diehards, you know, doesn't move the needle quite nearly as much as you see in Wilmington.
Yeah, it's an interesting dynamic. I mean, the students have consistently supported them, especially when they're winning, right? You know, I mean, they're pretty fired up about it on campus right now, as they should be. But the ticket holders, a lot of those folks didn't go to UNCW. They just have moved here or retired here or live here. And, you know, in lieu of being able to support their college, wherever that may be, they have adopted the Seahawks and, you know, supported it through ticket sales and donations and all the things that you want. So it's kind of a neat dynamic, and it really, you know, Siddle said it last night after the game, and Kevin Keats said the same thing when he was here, and Jerry Wainwright said the same thing two decades ago. It really is the city's team, you know, it's more enjoyable around here when they're doing well, and it helps lift the rest of that athletic department too, which is also you know, a key cog in, you know, the financial element of this. Not only are you looking at higher ticket revenues when they're winning, but more people are willing to open up their checkbook and, you know, donate to something that they feel like is on solid ground. So it's the flagship. I don't think there will ever be football here, although it gets discussed every once in a while. I think it will always be a basketball school. And I think it's really, yeah, it's a unique situation for sure.
Yeah, there's two schools. Oh, sorry, go ahead, Nate.
Well, I was going to ask, because I was down there. I got there in 2010 and then left in 2013. So I'm just looking. I left 1 year before Buzz Peterson got fired, and I guess I was in one of those, like, down periods. And what do you think, what would be one of the – is it coaching that made the difference between when they struggle versus when they're doing well? Anything you can do to explain that a little bit?
I think – I mean, that's a great question. And it's something I've thought about a lot because – I think it's a unique place. I don't think that everybody can figure out the code, if you will. I think all of those coaches who came in, for the most part, had ability. But, you know, timing is important. And a couple of those were, you know, younger coaches that were coming in, and the league was kind of hopping with a lot of good veteran coaches, and it was just difficult for them to break through. And Keats... you know, Wainwright and Brownell figured it out years ago a certain way, and then Keats came in with a completely different model that worked. And obviously the assistant Siddle, you know, who's the head coach now, has kind of patterned his program after what worked when he was here as an assistant. So certainly the most important person in any program is the coach. And, you know, we see it in mid-major basketball all the time where a program is rolling along at the top of their conference for years, contending for NCAA tournaments, playing in NCAA tournaments, and then they make the wrong hire, and all of a sudden they're completely forgotten. So it's fragile. You know, the ones that have generally had success have been able to promote from within and just kind of keep things going. That's ideally what you would hope for. You understand that your head coach, if you're successful, may get an offer from an ACC school that's going to pay them 10 times as much money or 8 times as much money. There's no way you can compete with that. That's fine. That's good for your program, in my opinion, when they do move on to a job of that caliber. But you would hope that you have a obvious candidate in-house to replace them with. And, you know, a lot of people felt that Siddle should have gotten the job when Keats left after the 2017 season. But, you know, the AD, for whatever reason, just didn't feel like he was ready at the time and he needed a little more seasoning. So he went with Kevin to NC State. And then, you know, it opened back up and he was kind of the obvious choice. And right now it looks like that was the right decision.
Yeah. So let's talk about that for a second. We were saying before the call that nobody's seen exactly what was coming here with UNCW. I mean, I was, you know, not a believer until we saw them go up to Towson, right, and do it on the road, and now Hofstra at home. Those are, to me, probably the two big heavyweights in the league right now, with Delaware, and I want to say Drexel behind them, although make me look like a fool every once in a while. But now they're clearly in the discussion. So I was going to ask you to kind of rate or bucket, you know the 10 teams in the league, but let's just start with, you know, is do you now feel that Wilmington is a powerhouse in this league right now?
Yeah, I think they're in this race until the end at this point. Now, whether that means they end up in first, they have a lot of challenges ahead, especially if you look at the end of the season, they finish with the Delaware Drexel trip. And, you know, they still have to go to Hofstra. So, I mean, they're going to have some games, and everybody's seen them now, too. So there'll be some, you know, there's a lot of good coaches in this league. There will be some adjustments made. But I feel like they've got three really strong ball handling, playmaking guards. And if you look back through the history of this conference over the last two decades, that's generally a thread among all the championship teams. Yeah, it's great to have a big man as well. But if you've got three guys on the perimeter who can make a play and force the defense to, you know, react and respect their ability to make a shot or get to the basket, you put a lot of pressure on the defense. And then I think when you add into that the fact they don't turn the ball over and they force turnovers, so they're creating extra possessions that way. And for a smaller team, albeit very athletic, they offensive rebound at a high rate as well. So they're getting some opportunities around the basket. And that's a good formula. I mean, that's a good formula for basketball at any level. If you're taking more shots than the opponent, I like your chances, you know, night after night. And that's something they've been able to do, is just get more looks at the basket. So I think, obviously, playing with a lot of confidence, this winning streak is going to come to an end at some point. And they've been very fortunate in a lot of these games. You just wonder if you can keep building, digging these, you know, double digit deficits and climb out of them. But I think they're playing with a tremendous amount of confidence, which is ultimately probably the most important thing any team can have.
Yeah, I mean, I think tomorrow's game sets up beautifully. You've got them coming off of a big win at home and obviously running the streak, and Drexel's coming off of a real tough loss, short rest on the road, the whole thing. And it's I think those teams are going to match up really nicely. I think it's going to be a nice Monday night game to have in front of us. It's kind of a cool treat to have it as a rescheduled game, as much of a challenge as it creates for Drexel's four straight road games here in a short nick of time. Looking forward to that one. So who else, I guess, do you have at the top then?
Yeah, I agree with you. I felt like Towson was the team to beat coming into the conference. I just thought they had shown by playing a variety of styles, different types of teams, winning on the road. You know, I really liked the way their team was coming together. They've not really been full strength in conference play or really even in the non-conference very often. You know, they've been down – you know, whether it was Gibson missed a game or two, and you know, Terry Nolan's kind of been in and out of the lineup, so, and Cam Holden fractured his jaw and has been playing with that mask. You know, so I don't know that we've necessarily seen their best in conference, but I think they're built to last. Charles Thompson's coming on and really emerging as one of the more consistent, tougher big guys. I thought he was I mean, he was elite in the second half, in particular that game against Drexel. Just his scoring around the basket and just physicality, you know, was really a difference maker in that game. And Hofstra is right there as well. I mean, it's been a little odd with them too. I mean, Cook's missed some games. Jalen Ray has not really been the Jalen Ray that we all know and are used to. They've had a little bit of issue in the front court, but I think they're healthier there. Kramer got into the game last night for a few minutes, so I think they're healthier there than they've been in some times, and I don't see them fading. So I think those three are definitely in, and then maybe there's a slight drop down to Delaware and Drexel. I like both of those teams. They can both look really, really good when the shots are falling, but they're both a little bit make or miss teams, if you will. You know, when they're making shots, they look really good, but when they go through a stretch where they're not, their defense and maybe the other little things that you can do on the offensive end to create points aren't necessarily there. And that always troubles me with the team, because especially as you get into projecting ahead to a conference tournament, you're not going to make shots very often three nights in a row. I mean, it can happen, but there's going to be one of those nights in there generally where you're going to have to fight through in other ways, especially in a league that I still think is extremely balanced. Felt like it was extremely balanced going into the season. And I felt like Towson and UNCW were the two hardest teams to predict in the preseason in a league where it had never been more difficult to predict because they had so many new faces. And you just didn't know how it was all going to come together in either situation. So, you know, JMU's been a disappointment. Of course, them losing Molson for the rest of the season is just a terrible blow for them. And their defense has been not good whatsoever in the conference. I think Charleston has a lot of upside. Maybe I thought they were going to be a little bit better with their pace. It's exciting and it's fun, but when it gets into conference play, it comes down to execution and possession by possession efficiency, and their youth has shown a little bit there. And then, you know, when you look at some of the teams at the bottom, I mean, arguably two of the better coaches in the league are down towards at the very bottom, and Mike Schrage and Bill Cullen. And I think in both cases there, you just have rosters that just don't fit together for whatever reason. I mean, Northeastern doesn't have a point guard on the roster, and it's a very difficult game to play without that somebody that's at least serviceable at that position. And Elon, just for whatever reason, I think they have some nice pieces, but I just don't think the mix is quite right yet. At the same time, you know, they're going to spoil some games for the contenders coming down the stretch. I mean, at home, those aren't going to be fun places to play necessarily.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that about Shragi, because I thought I was leading the bandwagon there for him for a long time now, and I keep feeling let down, but I'm happy to see other people continue to believe. I still think he's got Elon kind of moving in a good way. Team always seems to be young every year. I feel like they got a young team, but they have a young team, and I do think that you know, there's a program that's moving in the right direction.
Yeah, I think Michael Graham's terrific. He's had some moments, but I think, you know, you look at him as a second-year player. I mean, if they can hang on to him throughout his career, I mean, you're looking at a dominant-type big guy in the CAA on both ends of the court.
I guess the only team we haven't covered, unless I'm missing somebody shout at me, but William and Mary, who I get why we haven't touched on them, because they're like, I don't know, it's a 500 team-ish that is not at all, like, inspiring. Nobody's thinking they're threatened for the top. But also, we thought it was going to be like 0-18. So is it one of the more, if it wasn't for UNCW, is this one of the big surprises of the conference?
It's funny, I'll tell you, I was just about to ask about that, man. Everybody likes, just like everybody likes to pile on Flow Sports, everybody piles on their head coach. But I watched a game the other night against Charleston. I'm like, it carried over what happened to us. So, yeah, what do you think about that team?
I have eaten my words a little bit about William and Mary. I was not impressed. I watched quite a few of their non-conference games, and I just didn't see it. You know, I didn't see the growth. And then to their credit, you know, he stuck with those young guys, and whatever he was doing behind the scenes clicked right before conference play, which is what you would want. And they have been a different team. They've been a much better team. They still have some flaws. They still make some youthful mistakes, but they're big. You know, they've got some nice three big guys, you know, in the front court, and their guards have started to step up and make some plays. And, you know, I think they're another team that, again, I don't think they're going to win the conference tournament or, you know, challenge for the regular season title, but I could certainly see them winning three or four more conference games, which they were the unanimous number 10. I mean, they were the only easy pick in the preseason as far as 1 through 9 was a nightmare. Like I spent, I shuffled my order time after time and they just seemed the clear choice for 10th. But, you know, Fisher's brought in some nice talent in the freshman and sophomore classes. And I think if he, again, that's a group, if he can keep it together, which William and Mary's traditionally been able to do that, that they could be a force to be reckoned with down the road.
So I want you to disagree with this statement. I've been following this league since 2001. This is, for me, top to bottom, the best group of coaches that I think I remember this league having. I don't know that there's any of them that you'd really sell on, right?
That's a bold statement. I can't disagree with it. I think of the era when it was Larinaga, Shaver, you know, Anthony Grant, Blaine Taylor. I mean, the Bruiser, there weren't many off nights then either. But the league's changed a little bit since then. Not quite as many top 100 caliber teams as we used, you know, like there used to be. But yeah, top to bottom, I think everybody's got their own style. Pat Kelsey has been a terrific addition to the conference down at Charleston, you know, replacing a good coach in Earl Grant. And yeah, there's not really a team you could look at. I was a little interested to see how Speedy would do in his first year because you just always wonder about any first year head coach, but I think he's done a great job. He's going to be a terrific recruiter. Certainly, you know, he can sell what guys want to hear. He played at the highest level, and that's what the guy coming into college wants to hear, that he can help him get there. And yeah, I would agree. I mean, it is, there aren't any weak spots. That's for sure. I think to your point, maybe it was stronger at the top at one time, but top to bottom, maybe as good as it's ever been.
Yeah. I'd say it's something. It's a great sign for where the conference is moving. Smart hires take you a long way. We just talked about the difference in what a head coach means at Wilmington, but it's across the board. And yeah, I mean, we do wish Tony Shaver maybe was still around, but Dane Fisher is accrediting himself. So, you know, you got to give him his own opportunity in what is a really challenging place to coach. So,
right.
Credit to him for getting them where they've been. So, I guess on, you know, our favorite topic around here these days, everybody's favorite topic, which is who's going to land where, when. I don't think we're going to – we did a full podcast maybe a week and a half ago on kind of – the CAA's total plans and the idea of moving towards 16 teams and maybe Olympic sports divisions and this, that, setting yourself up for some kind of Division I split even potentially, you know, at some point. And I think that's all relevant and in the picture. So the Southern Flank, though, has had some developments this week, and we had Mike Brodsky talking about that one, and him and I are both pretty we have our ears to the ground up here a little bit, but maybe a little bit weaker in the South, so leaning on you a little bit. The big news of the week here, it sounds like the Patriot League is buttoning up. They're happy with where they're at. I don't think that it really mattered. I don't know that either the two schools discussed is potentially going that direction, which is William and Mary and Northeastern really ever had any desire to go that way. But even if they did, it sounds like that door is maybe more shut than we expected. But then the larger one is, College of Charleston, which is one of the schools that, you know, maybe has aspirations, right? They're going to be basketball centric, and they know what they are. They know what their flagship is. They have a brand. They're trying to grow it. Their athletic director comes out in the paper and says, you know, this is the CAA. This is our plan. We're part of this plan. And this is how we as a league are going to look to grow. So it sounds like, you know, they're in. That's a statement that says we're in. We're at least in for a few more years anyway, right? Which is all anybody can stipulate to. So if they're in, if the William & Mary, the Patriots stop, can put on the back burner. I actually think Elon loves a league. You tell me if I'm wrong, but loves a league that is Northeast exposure, but you can play your Olympic sports only in the South. I think that's exactly what they want. So I feel like the Southern end of the CA is maybe a little more entrenched than we thought it was, especially now they've added Hampton.
I would agree. I don't know what good options any of them have, to be honest with you. quite frankly. I don't foresee Elon wanting to leave and go back to the Southern Conference. That doesn't really make sense for all the reasons that you mentioned. They do kind of dislike being the southernmost football playing member, you know, but that's just something that, you know, they'll have to make some trips to Virginia for that sport. Wilmington is in an interesting spot. The Big South has just not ever been an appealing option. They like the academic association of being in the Colonial, as they've grown their academic standards pretty rapidly in the last decade, especially just each decade. It's still a pretty young school, and you know, it's one of the more difficult schools to gain admission in the UNC system now, which is 17 or 18 universities. It's a popular place. It's expanding, and undergraduate enrollment has almost doubled. And they enjoy being associated with the Northeasterns and Drexels and Hofstras of the world on the academic stage. So I think that the Southern ADs and maybe presidents as well have kind of taken upon themselves to, okay, this is where we are. This is our house. We're not looking to buy a new house. How can we make this house better? You know, how can we expand on it? And who do we try to attract that fits our profile? And I think they started with Furman and Wofford, which were obvious, you know, candidates, both really solid basketball members and would fit. But I think with the Southern Conference doubling its exit fee, I think to $2 million, I think that kind of reflects directly on those conversations. And I don't know, again, why those schools would want to leave the Southern Conference. So then you have to start looking a little broader, and maybe a North Carolina A&T, who recently went from the MEAC to the Big South. Maybe Howard, which, you know, isn't quite as far south maybe as they would like. But I know that High Point has some interest. I don't know if that interest is reciprocated in any fashion, but those would all, I think they would love to grab two more. And to me, North Carolina A&T and Howard probably make the most sense if there's interest on their side as well.
Yeah, obviously the Howard interest is something we spoke about, and I think it would be a great ad for the CAA. It's a prestigious school, and it's just a matter of if they want to come, right? And the school you didn't touch on was Campbell. That's the other one I think that's out there. It's a bit of a wild card. I don't know what their level of interest is or the CAA's level of interest, but at some point it's going to come down to, I agree with you, I think they want to add two teams from the South, you know, get our proper divisions. I think they're going to be able to find another one in the North. It won't be hard. It'll be Albany. It'll be Quinnipiac. I think I'm a Quinnipiac fan in that particular regard, but it sounds, you know, we'll see how things go up there, but either one of those may happen. But I think the only add one, if you want to look and add two for the South, for the Southern, you know, for the Southern teams, at some point it's going to come down to being pragmatic, right? You get to build your own conference to a point, but if you decide we need two, you got to find a second one, you know, right, who matches up with you. And that's going to be, I think everybody's now kind of nailed down A&T as it seems like they would be interested. It seems like the CA would have interest. That makes sense. But who that other school is, you know, if you can't move Howard, gets challenging.
I mean, Campbell, a couple hours up the road, they've played, I think Wilmington's played them more than any other school in basketball. I mean, they've both been playing since the pre-Division I days back in the 60s and early 70s. They have a solid basketball program. They have a nice arena that's less than 10 years old. They have football. They have a nice little football stadium as well. I mean, they've invested some money into their facilities as well. It's about an hour from Raleigh. It's not the easiest place in the world to get to, you know, for travel purposes. I think the folks at Campbell enjoy being in a bus league, you know, the Big South, which has now gone to divisions in basketball to even make travel better. You know, they like that aspect of it. So I don't know that they would have the interest in driving to Raleigh and hopping on airplanes, you know, quite as much, or the financial means to do so. They would be a solid addition. I don't know that they would be at the top of my list necessarily, but if you needed a second school, I think they would do just fine, and bring a little bit to the table as well.
That's a very polite way of calling that a bad idea. I appreciate it.
It's interesting, because sometimes I said, like, how does Wilmington fit in with the league? So you're saying, even from that academic perspective, which I guess I don't always think about too, and I think it come up, you got to think of everything, not just the sports, but the academic end of things. So you're saying they really like that idea of being associated with the Northeast schools and everything like that.
I think so. I mean, I think it's something that has evolved. I don't think it was always the case. I think there were times when, they looked back longingly on the days when the CAA was just them and a bunch of schools from Virginia and were like, man, we wish we could go back to that. But I think any realistic person realizes that the days of tight geographic regional conferences are gone. And at this point, you have to look at what's best for you and for the whole university, because ultimately the decision is not coming from the athletic department. You know, it's coming from the top, and they have to be completely invested and on board with it as well. And, you know, the CAA is an opportunity now where it should be thinking about trying to compete with the A-10 and quit worrying about the fact that VCU and George Mason and Old Dominion left. I kind of feel like we've been in that, for 5 or 6 years. Well, we're never going, the league's never going to be what it was because they left and they were all top 100 programs pretty consistently. Well, okay, well, they're gone. They've been gone. And now is an opportunity for the CAA to grow it, itself, especially basketball, which is its primary sport, that people know the CAA is a basketball conference, and do things to invest as much as possible to maybe become a rival to the A-10 in some way, or a potential multi-bid league again. Cause Dan remembers we used to have those conversations every year, and it wasn't, it was very realistic. And Drexel came up on the short end of one of those situations 1 year, and Hofstra came up on the short end of one of those situations 1 year, but other schools benefited, by getting in as an at-large, and then what George Mason and VCU did certainly is historical. So I just think the CAA is at an interesting point where it needs to think big and try to become as strong as it can on the basketball court.
I think you raise first point of order. Drexel came up short twice in those regards, not just once.
True,
but yeah. I think it's a great point, and I think they're trying to have their cake and eat it too a little bit here. We're going to make an East Coast multimedia market basketball league with a bus league for all the other sports, besides football, which is its own kind of entity. And that's a great way to keep costs down, keep your exposure up. And at the same time, we have this kind of people have been hiring smartly. We see some money being invested. A lot of these schools, because they're in cities, are not going to get the facilities investments that maybe you'd like to see, but they're putting their money where their mouth is, whether it's coaching staff or local exposure, getting on the TV, everything else. So you're seeing some spend. You're right. The overarching thing for me is, how is it that there's nobody in the top 100 in this conference right now, and hasn't been for years, it feels like. It needs to be better. The overall product on the floor needs to be better, and that will get you – that will buy you some exposure.
Yeah. But
it feels like they're, in a position to do that now.
They have to make some bold choices, and not to get too deep in the weeds, but I was having this conversation with somebody in the industry recently, and they need to pay their officials more. I was looking just before I came on, I did a quick scan. Ken Pomeroy has a very what he would describe as primitive ref ratings on his website, and it's impossible to rate refs, but his theory is the best refs, the supervisors of each conference's officials know who the best officials are, so they put them on the best games. So he basically has created a point system based around that and how often a guy works. And so he's rated the top 200 officials. Now, again, how can you rate the top, if you ask 20 different people to rate the top 10 officials, you would get 20 different lists. But last night, for example, I didn't see a single top 150 official on a Saturday night when there's 130 games, a single top 150 official working a CAA game. It was generally one guy in the 151 to 200 range, and then two guys not even in the top 200. Then you go look over at like the A-10, which had a big game yesterday, VCU and Richmond. They've got three top 150 guys on that crew, which tells me they're more experienced. They're a little more seasoned. And the reason they're getting better officials, because they have the same supervisor, is because they get paid more. The A-10's paying their officials more. You know, these guys are independent contractors, and the supervisors are going to take care of the top, you know, the leagues that higher on the pecking. So that's the decision that they're going to have to make. And it's an investment from each university and the conference as a whole. But we've all seen these debacles on the court with the and I'm the biggest official fan in the world. Like, I understand those guys have a hard job, and like, I'm the last guy to crush them. But, you know, UNCW Hofstra play a huge game last night, and it kind of got marred in the second half by the crew, an inexperienced crew, not being able to handle an environment like that with 4,000 people and two pretty physical teams going at it. And I think that's just one way where you can kind of put a brighter face on your conference night in and night out, or quit playing on Saturdays altogether, which is a different conversation. But that would be another way to solve that problem.
Right. Because it's funny. You touched on it. I was going to say, you know, the A-10 plays on Sundays, and it's cool because I'm a father of a young child as well. I don't have a ton of extra time at the house, but if I flip on a TV on a Sunday and I caught VCU, you know, I was supposed to be on at noon today. And they're going to be out there. They're going to be out there with a good TV, you know, exposure because nobody else is playing, with good referees because nobody else is playing. They kind of jumped ahead and took that line before the CAA got there, and it was smart, and they profited from it, I think. But you can see the difference between Thursdays and Saturday. We've been saying this for years, you know. But Thursday, Drexel got in James Madison, and I made this joke on Twitter because I don't know how these three guys, you know, upset Brian Kersey enough to be sent to Harrisonburg on a Thursday night. But they had Mike Roberts, Brian O'Connell, and TV Teddy.
Yeah.
On a Thursday night in Harrisonburg, which is like, I can't believe those three guys showed up there.
Yeah.
But they were there. They were working it, and we had a really well officiated game, is what we had. You know, and we've had Brian O'Connell three times this season now, which I feel fortunate about. And you know who the good ones are, and you know the guys. You know, we showed up Saturday, and I looked at 15 minutes before the 1,000 game. I looked at the stats, and I said, "Oh no," you know. And that's Nathan Hall's back. You know. But yeah, it's something we've talked about forever in this conference. And yeah, whether it's, I feel like they don't want to move to Sunday because the perception of doing what the A-10's doing, you know, or whatever the case might be. But I don't know that Thursday, Saturday, I guess for travel, maybe it's ideal. But they got to figure something out that, you know.
Coaches would love Thursday, Sunday, because, you know, coaches love prep time, and that would give them an extra day, you know, to prep for that back end opponent. Because sometimes they feel like if there's some travel, you know, significant travel, and then maybe you run into some problems like can happen in the winter, and then you just really get very little on-court prep for that second game. So I think most of the coaches would be in favor of that. Now, I know that Sunday has traditionally been the women's day in the CAA too, so I don't know if that would cause a problem. They would have to maybe reconfigure. But those are just things that – these are kind of discussions that they should be – we can have them all day, and it's great, but these are the discussions that need to be held in the office and at the meetings just to try to grow the basketball product going forward.
Well, so play them as double headers on Sunday and save some money. That's how you sell it, right? I mean, go ahead, Dave.
Go ahead, Eric. Eric, where are you?
You got an extra hotel night in there too, so you have to consider that in your travel costs. And then you have to find a place to play practice. You have to find another gym for that extra day.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Well, you got to decide if you're going to come home after Thursday or if you're going to stay on the road both nights.
And I would say one team breaking out of the pack here, and I don't know, maybe UNC Wilmington's that team. We'll see what happens. But, I mean, so far, so good as far as they go. So, we want to keep you all night. So, I guess, Dan, you want to say any last questions or anything you got?
I had a follow-up on that last one. I did, which is, what, in your opinion, Brian, because we have talked about this till we're blue in the face a little bit, but what is the effect of having – weaker referees? Is that damage the league competitively in one way or the other? I'm assuming that you're worried about, you know, inconsistent victories essentially and playoff resumes. But where is your concern buried there?
Yeah, I mean, as far as good calls and bad calls, that probably all works itself out, you know, in the end, and the better teams probably prevail. I just think that the quality of the product that you're putting on the court for the fans, for the coaches, and for the players, you know, nobody comes to watch the four fouls on all the starters, you know, and I think better, stronger officials understand how to let teams play, especially top level teams in whatever league they're working. They understand the magnitude of a game. They don't get affected as much by the environment necessarily. And they allow the game to be played with the flow without having to call every foul. Whereas I think younger officials, they feel like they have to call it by the letter of the law and by the book a little bit. The problem is when you do that and don't give the players a little bit of leeway, you end up with a lot of stops and starts, and then maybe the game gets a little heated. So I just think it affects the overall product. I don't think anybody's ever bought a ticket to watch free throws or to watch the best players sit on the bench.
I think no calls are underrated. We just don't see enough of them at any level.
100%. Like, the block charge thing, I mean, we could talk about that for hours, but, you know, it's we're rewarding a guy for jumping in front of a guy who's making a basketball play a lot of times and sending the ball the other way. And yeah, just the understanding. When Kersey was working games, he was the best at communicating with the players, in particular the post guys, if he was along the baseline, of like kind of letting them know where the line was and when they were about to cross it, and then feeling, you know, communicating. And I think that's what the best officials do. You know, they're not there to simply enforce the rules, but they're there to make the game better and, you know, let the players understand. And, you know, that's the players and coaches' job to react to how the game's going to be called each night. Some are a little looser, some are a little tighter. But I just think that consistency across the board, it just it leaves everybody walking away from the arena, win or lose, feeling like the players determine the game and not the people with the whistles.
All right. Hey, Brian, thanks for coming on. I really appreciate the time. It is unfortunate. I know every time I see you, I talk to you, I think about Mookie Betts, and I send my best to him and your friends in Los Angeles.
We're glad to have him.
Have a great night. Yeah.
Thanks. Thanks, guys. Enjoyed it. Y'all have a good one.
Thank you. All right, we're back. I appreciate Brian Mole coming on. I know my big takeaway there, I sometimes, I don't say a bad mouth the Southern schools like UNC Wilmington, but sometimes I don't know how well they fit, but putting a face to the name was really helpful, seeing him and talk to him and get that perspective of how much, you know, their school appreciates having, you know, the Northern schools in there was helpful for me. So, and very knowledgeable, great guest, Dan, thanks for setting that up, and maybe we'll have him. And it occurred to me, hey, we play him tomorrow night, so that's perfect. So, yeah, I didn't realize that right away.
That's where I was supposed to leave us with that. We're supposed to talk about that game a little bit more, but we are having so much fun talking about everything else that we ran long on that section. And I'm, you know, I appreciate Brian for coming on. He's a great guy, and what we were just saying offline, very knowledgeable, inside and outside of the game, and it's a pleasure to have him.
Yeah, and putting a face to the name around the conference, so I think that's helpful for everybody. So, all right, so we're gonna start by talking about the men's team. So the happier news of the week was our win down at James Madison on Thursday night. Drexel won 88-82. What were some overall takeaways that you guys had from the game there on Thursday?
I mean, the loss of Molson was big for JMU. The game kind of turned, I felt like, right around then. They was playing a little more even. But for me, two takeaways. One, yeah, we can be pretty good at times. Actually, three takeaways. We can be pretty good at times. And two, JMU does not look good. They really don't look like they're adding up to expectations right now. They've had some injuries, I'll note, but that Mark Byington said in the post game that his personnel doesn't match up with his defensive alignments right now. He's still figuring out. He's still tinkering with his defense, which, by the way, did not get fixed before this Delaware game yesterday. But That to me is the – I told you guys on the last piece that Brian called my Campbell idea dumb, as politely as you can. That is as politely as you will hear a coach call his own players not good at defense. I mean, like, you know, we don't have the personnel to support my defense. He's calling out his players. He's doing it in a polite way, and maybe he's thinking his kids won't understand what he's doing. but he's calling out his players hard. And I think that's an intriguing for a team that's struggling right now to have a coach go into the media and say something about his kids can't play his system. I think that's it's bold. I think Mark Byington is a winner take all guy. I think he wants to win at all cost, and I think we're seeing a little bit of that. And I'm wondering how that team's going to respond. Obviously, did not respond well against Delaware yesterday. The third piece of it is, and this is the more Drexel centric piece, I really, and it's funny because of what happened on Saturday, but I really like what Zach Spiker did in that game. You know, the only way JMU was going to win that game, especially after Molson went out, was going to be turning the Dragons over. He's got some aggressive guys on the team. We talk about the team not being aggressive enough, and we say when they're not being aggressive, you put in Xavier Bell, you put in Lamar Odin, right? You kind of let your guys go out there and run and throw some elbows. He did the opposite here, right? He retreated. He put in Matei Jurek and Cam Winter and let the guards, you know, the Sessomore JB. Obviously, he was coming back. That was big. But went with a bit of a more less aggressive approach, we'll call it, which is what you want when the only way they're going to beat you is by turning you over. Mm-hmm. You put a bunch of ball handlers on the floor. It was successful. And they kind of closed out that game. So I thought it was smartly done. Obviously, he did the same thing against Towson, which I thought was kind of crazy. But we'll get there. But I thought it was one of the coaching staff's better games I've seen, just personally. I thought they did an exceptional job in that game.
Yeah. Eric, what did you think?
James Madison game?
Yeah.
Yeah, the James Madison game, I think we just to reiterate what Brian said earlier, was live and die by the three. And they lived that night. Drexel went, I think they had 11 or 12 of their threes in the first half, I believe. The second half, they didn't shoot as much. They ended up with 50% for the game. So that little throwback to the CAA tournament. Shot 55% for the game. That was 88 points. A lot of points. I think that might be their high mark for the year for points per game. They had it going that night. Williams, 21 points, 12 boards. Had a breakout night. It's fantastic. You got four of the five guys in double figures. Malik Martin at 8 points. He's almost there too. So it's just a really nice balanced attack.
Yeah, I guess. And looking back, it was like, and now that we're talking about how bad the James Madison defense was. Like on one hand, it was like the first half, it was like our 3-point game was what we really focused. And then the second half is when we kind of went inside. And I guess what I was trying to think about, were we taking what they gave them? Did they adjust, or it was kind of like, oh, we just felt like we're going inside, but. I mean, yeah, Amari had a huge second half. He had like 16 points. So, I don't know how much of that was, us enforcing our will, or we just could do whatever we wanted against them when it came down to it.
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of both. I think, Eric, your point is true. The first half, the 3-point shooting was huge. And obviously, JMU was hot too. And that was a 3-point game at halftime, even though Drexel was hitting everything under the sun. Mm-hmm. And part of that was because Drexel brutally flubbed up their execution in the final minute. Gave him back about 6 points. But the second half, they go out, they only hit one three.
We took five, too, in the second half. So it was a totally different
approach. Either JMU really expanded out, or to Nate's point, we decided to adjust. But it was good. I thought that was the argument against Brian's argument and our argument that they live by the three, die by the three, because they were able to prove, they scored more points in the second half than they did on the first. That's tough to do, hit 11 threes in a half and outscore that half in the second part. JMU was – clearly limited defensively, but it was good to see us be able to do different things in different ways and be successful almost across the board. So that was a good game for them. I thought across the board, players had to be happy with the execution, coaches had to be happy with the game plan and how it worked out. Like I say, there were some blips last minute of the first half in particular, but by and large, pretty solid game.
You mentioned too, Bell. He had 5 turnovers, and I worry a little bit about what's going there. And some of that, I guess, our sophomore is a little uneven. They'll have a really solid. Like, I'm thinking back to his game at Hofstra where he was unbelievable, and ever since then, I feel like just hasn't been able to even come close to that. I'm not sure what's going on there.
He likes to really take it to the hoop. It's pretty aggressive like that. It's probably one of the only guys who does that, and just finds like it loses the handle on the way in. Mm-hmm. The leverage turnovers are versus, unforced errors.
And I guess the same thing, it's like, and I'm not looking at it close enough, are teams adjusting to that? Maybe like throw it a defender in the paint? Because, I feel like he gets to a certain point now, and then he does kind of like a jump stop. in the lane, and then he doesn't really know what to do, and that's where he's throwing the ball away. So maybe teams are adjusting to him. We backed him down really well against Hofstra too, and maybe again that was just a matchup we saw that we could use. But yeah, I think he hurt us a little bit, and like it's 15 turnovers as a team, but we seemed to tighten up when we needed to. It's still a nice road win overall. Felt good about things afterwards. So, all right. Anything else you guys want to point out from that game that jumped out for you?
No, the devil of the media. Nobody wants to talk about wins.
And do want to highlight. Yeah. I mean, Amari Williams had a monster second half. I mean, it was incredible. So, let's go to yesterday. Drexel loses at Towson, 66-62. A game that we had a 14-point lead with our largest lead right before half, and then it all went away. So let's talk about that one. What did you guys think about yesterday?
Yeah, so it looked like Towson made some nice adjustments at halftime. You know, Drexel pretty much had their way in the first half. Towson was still very cold, like the first Towson matchup in three. They only went 2-11 for the game. They don't have much backcourt play. Very interesting, but they played tenacious defense. They turned up the defense strongly in the second half, expanded the 3D, so Drexel didn't seem to shoot the three as much. Went underneath and had a lot of good looks underneath, but just couldn't finish around the rim. It was very frustrating. Seeing Amari Williams, he went 5-for-13 from the field, and they're all bunnies, and he missed some really easy ones, but there was a lot of pressure, I will say. So I give a lot of kudos to Towson in that game. They all turned it up. They do it all with defense. They're not a pretty team. They never are. But it worked for them that night.
And look at it. I was thinking about Amari because you're right. Yeah, he missed some shots he'd like him to miss. But I mean, Thompson, and I didn't realize this, he was 7-of-7 in the second half.
Yeah,
and then he was 11-of-14 for the game. So, I mean, you wonder how much the defense was affecting the offense and vice versa. They knew what they wanted to do in the second half and jammed it down our throats pretty much. So, Dan, what did you think about the game yesterday?
Yeah, I mean, Towson's, they're long, they're big, you know, that creates problems on the outside, but they were missing Nolan, who's their point guard. So that's a tough, you know, it's a big opportunity for the Dragons to go in there against a really high-ranked team and take advantage of maybe them missing somebody, and they're in a position to do it. Obviously fell apart. Nate, just because we've talked enough this year, I know you're going to talk about the Princeton game, right? We'll talk about Tulane. There's another one that got away, right? I feel like I watched the end of that game, and I looked at the record of 8-8, and I said, you know, the voice of Nate Hemmerly crept in the back of my head, and he said, you know, the record is who you are, and the farther we go into the season, the record is who you are, and at some point, it doesn't matter how talented these guys are. If they're not winning the games, you know, these close games, they got the close win against St. Joe's, but that probably wasn't as close as, you know, it looks in the final score. And they had the win at Towson, which we all kind of agree they didn't deserve to win, you know, the first game. Those two played at home. They really, these close, you know, the wins by and large, though, outside of those have been big wins. Crushed Elon. Really, James Madison was more of a crushing than it looked in the final score. Mm-hmm. Northeastern, you know, beat them up. Coppin State, closer than it looked, but still, you knew who was going to win that game. You know, these games where they're Charlotte's the same way. These games where they're winning are the games that kind of you walked in the court 5 minutes in, you knew they were going to win, and the ones that are, you know, too close to call, they're not getting the breaks to go their way, and you create your own breaks, you coach your own breaks, you don't know if they're just really snake bit, but I don't think we were giving Bruiser Flint a lot of the benefit of the doubt late in his career on these kind of toss up games that he just never seemed to come on the right side of. And we're seeing this here, and a lot of people are putting the coaching staff. I'll hesitate there. They won the championship last year. We seem to get more shots than the other team most games, and they seem to be better shots than the opponents are getting. So, hypothetically, that should translate. I get on a macro level how that works, and this should be working. But obviously, you know, just looking – I didn't see the stretch there where things really got away. I do know when you're up big, what you really need to do is control those first few minutes at a halftime. And as soon as Towson came out of the half, shooting lights out, you knew you were in trouble. You know, like I said, they went with that Urich. They went small. Urich and Coltrane and Cam. and I didn't get it. I guess that team, I don't understand that matchup.
Yeah, and I was deliberately trying not to talk about the Princeton game because you're right. I talk about it all the time because it was such a disappointment. And this one was worse because in that game we could hold the lead, but we totally kind of fell apart in the second half. They pressured us. They ran a full court press, and we started turning the ball over. And then, yeah, I mean, they made shots, but you're right. I'm not sitting here saying, believe me, I'm not saying, fire. I was a big fire bruiser guy. I'm not doing that to Zach Spiker right now, but we don't have a sample size on him yet, because for me, this is the first sort of full season where we're seeing him with Division I players and a national roster that I feel like you can actually kind of assess what he's doing. And what I saw yesterday was, the way I was thinking about it, it was almost like, and this for our whole season, the two teams come out, shake hands, say, hey, we're going to run our half court offense. You run your half court offense. We're not going to do anything different. We're just going to run our stuff. Like a pickup game, you're just going to go out, but with plays and that sort of thing. But I feel like as soon as the other team starts to make a little adjustment here or there, we don't have an answer. And for me, it was they came out of the second half impressed, and then they went right at Thompson. They weren't shy about it. And to me, at some point, it's like, can we do a double team? Can we press? And I guess the other thing that bothered me too, and Eric will back me up. I don't think I really talked to you much. You were sitting at the end of the row, and I was in a little bit. And, I sat there and I'm like, you just saw them come back and then they took the lead and then they're up 10. And I didn't see any real sense of urgency. Like, wow, not only are they beating us, but they're like pulling away. And that's what I got. Eric will back me up. I got kind of pissed. And I was just what is it going to hit somebody that we've totally let this game slip away? And that's what kind of bothered me yesterday. So, Eric, I don't know what you thought.
I'm looking at the ESPN here. There's a flat line here in, the middle of the second half. I want to say it was, at least 6 minutes. Did we have 6 minutes without a
point? Yeah, it was 6 minutes and change.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
Because somebody used a good term today that I'm going to steal. They called it hero ball. That was our offense with Cam Winter. It's like it's going to be 1-on-5 with Cam, and either he's going to score or he's not. And it kept us afloat for the first maybe five minutes, first part of the second half. And then, I don't rip Juric as much as other people. But it was obvious they got whatever matchup and whatever matchup they wanted, whether it was holding on him and even Rizzuto, the first half, they got nothing out of their role players. The second half, Rizzuto was backing him down. They were getting open looks. It was just obvious what Towson was doing to attack us. And I had no clue what we were doing.
Well, Juric, last two games, 23, 24 minutes. And I don't want to knock the guy. He is who he is. He deserves to play. He doesn't deserve to play that many minutes. I know you got 9 guys you got to play. You can't play everybody all game. Can't play 39 minutes. But I just don't think you're going to win games. You win many games against a Towson if you're playing with Juric for 24 minutes. He had straight zeros. He had nothing. He had nothing on offense. Had a few turnovers. I'm not saying he was a difference in the game. I thought it was a team effort that they didn't win. But I just don't get it. I don't get the playing time.
I think he deserved to be on the floor against JMU. I think he's been a spark plug for this team at times, defensively especially. We talk about the lack of toughness at times, and that he can bring that off the bench, and he really gets after it. I think I've seen him on the floor, even in limited minutes, more than I've seen any other player on the floor in this team this year. I think he's a guy who's, leaves his heart and soul out there, and I appreciate everything he does as a Dragon. I agree. I think JMU, where you wanted discipline, And you really wanted just to hang on to the ball and execute. He's a great guy to have on the floor. I think JB is the same way at this point a little bit. But I think that, Towson was not the right place for him. They're long, they're challenging. Besides the fact that he was not going to be a plus offensively, he was getting beaten defensively. And you've got to be able to read that and understand that and pivot a little faster than they did. So that's upsetting. I think, you call it faith, you can call it ego, right? But I think we see, one of the criticisms of Zach Spiker for 5 years now has been he's a little late with his timeouts. And I think you see sometimes, right, a team that's up big, it's up 15 and the league gets cut to 7 and the coach calls timeout and you go, that's a good timeout, right? That you kind of, you felt like the flow was going one way and you got the timeout. And, I feel like this was, I think the timeout wasn't called until it was a 2-point game. And I felt like it was a little bit late. I mean, Drexel was still leading by 2, but it was probably a little bit later than it needed to be. I think the subs during that 6 minute stretch, there was very few subs actually, which, you know, is a little bit surprising when you go that long without making a bucket that you wouldn't look to move personnel. So I think that sometimes you have a plan and you think it's going to work, and you so believe that you just keep throwing it out there. And I think that they are at times, speaking as a staff here, a little, they believe in themselves. They believe in their plan. They believe in their players. There's nothing on his face wrong with that. But if you play poker that way and you believe in your hand and you keep throwing money on the floor, right, you're not going to be a very good poker player.
Well, I guess
you got to understand what the hand you're holding versus the hand they're holding. Yeah. You got to adjust a little faster.
I get, well, just to say with Juric, I'm with you. I mean, I feel like he's been a good spark plug at times this year. So I haven't really killed him much, but I'm not trying to be a analytics guy, but he was minus 10 yesterday. So, I mean, so yesterday, like you said, Taos is more, they're longer, athletic. It was a bad matchup for him. So they need to make an adjustment. But my bigger concern is, like, I can't figure out what the plan is. And we'll talk about the women here. I'll make it as brief as I can. But, you know, you feel like I watched a women's game and I know what we're trying to do. Like, you know, and we've got two quick guards. So we use our defense to trigger our offense. We get out in transition. We get open jump shots for our guards. We use our offense with our motion. We get layups for our bigs underneath. We crash the offensive board. We get 30 buckets. Like, I know what the women's team is trying to do. I don't know what the men's team's. I mean, that was nice of James Madison. It's like, hey, first half, we're trying to shoot threes, did that well. And the second half, okay, we're going to pound it inside to Amari. And that's, that's my defense with Spiker. Guys are inconsistent. You know, Amari didn't have the best game. He's going against Thompson. He's going against one of the bigger, better, big men in the league. So, but sometimes we sub and I'm like, okay, why did we do that? Like, what does this guy coming in give us that the guy that came out, didn't? And that's my issue. I'm not picking up on sometimes what we're trying to do and where the, I don't know if you guys figure out the subs or not, but I struggle with that when we move guys in and out. So
a couple things. I think Charles Thompson, clearly proving he's one of the best big men in the league. He was the difference in that game, no question. Which, as somebody who's been so high on Amari, really impressed to see somebody, just kind of clearly be a step above him. Now he's a junior, he's a class above, but really, those two, when they battle out next year, that's a matchup worth tuning in for, just for those two alone, I think. But I think the word you're looking for is identity, Nate.
Yeah.
Right? And you look at William & Mary was an 82 possession game. That's a really high tempo game. Your average game in the league this year is probably, around 67, 68 possessions. So 82 possessions is a lot. William & Mary, we ran with them, and obviously part of that was us trying to Drexel trying to catch up with them because they got a decent lead and they have forced possessions late, but it was a fast up-tempo game. James Madison was a 73 possession game, so kind of a little high tempo but more middle of the road. And then Towson was a 59 possession game, so a very slow game. That's we haven't seen those since Bruce was here. So you have three games in a row played in totally different sprint speeds. And how much are we dictating the game? How much are the opponents dictating the game? And I think you really have to be like, no, we're playing to the point that you guys made the other day with Spiker saying, we're taking what they give us. There's an element of that that's okay, but at some point you do want to have an identity. You do want to force your will upon the opponent. And I think what you're saying, Nate, is that you're not seeing us do that, and I tend to agree.
Well, I think I we're at our best, and that's why, we were up, what was it, 34-20 at halftime? So we played we're at our best, I feel like, when we played a half-court game, each team, running their offense on either end. But then as soon as there's an adjustment, and specifically on Saturday of press, it sped us up. We ran our off. It happened against Delaware when, they were hitting shots, and we got behind, and we panicked, and we start rushing our half-court offense. So I think that's where we're at our best. And then when we get hit with a punch, it's like we kind of get away from that and we don't know what else to do. So, and then within our half court, once you take away certain things, it's like we can't necessarily find something else or decide what we want to attack. So that's my, again, I don't want Spiker out of here or whatever. And the only thing I'll say is, again, maybe we're gearing up for March. I feel like half court teams tend to do the best in a tournament situation because theoretically you have teams that aren't going to turn the ball over. They're going to defend. So you have to score in the half court, but you also need to be able to, if someone presses you, you still have to be able to run the half court. You can't just throw the ball away, and lose your composure. So,
That's it. They have to figure. For me, the biggest weakness of this team right now is facing pressure. They've got to figure that out. They have to get the ball handlers on the floor. Obviously, Trey Brown has taken a back seat of late. I think ideally Trey Brown is going to move on to the ball at some point. Cam Winner is going to be the second guy off the ball, so you didn't need Yurik there. And clearly, for whatever reason, Trey is not getting the minutes. It hasn't looked great, so maybe that's the reason. But, you know, you're hurting. That's a big weakness for this team right now. And if they can't figure that out, that's going to be the defining weakness of this team, because that's really why the team is 500 right now. Abilene was pressure, you know. Tulane threw some pressure at us. Towson threw some pressure at us. And every time somebody's thrown, I don't know how coaches aren't pressing us all night. I don't care what you normally do. I don't know how this team is not getting pressed all night. I don't know how. For the credit I gave to CA coaches on this call today, I have no idea how this is not getting exploited more. I thought, you know, I'm just stunned that hasn't happened yet.
You kind of wonder why James Madison. I think a lot of our turnovers were kind of self-inflicted as opposed to press. I mean, they're quick. I mean, they got in, you know, challenged us and stuff, but yeah, no, it's a good way to defend us. That's for sure.
So we'll see what's happening. But right now they're a frustrating 8-18, you know, I think you're spot on, Nate, and it should be better than that. The talent's better than that. So we'll see if they can pull it together here in what's going to be a crazy February schedule. And obviously the next games, we got a Monday nighter against undefeated in conference UNCW on the road on short rest, back-to-back games on short rest. You know, Wilmington is probably going to be like a pick-em game to Vegas because they still haven't caught up to how good Wilmington's been playing. But Wilmington, to me, is a heavy favorite. But the Dragons have something to prove, right? They're coming off this loss, and they have not lost. Let me look here, but I don't believe they've lost two in a row. There's Princeton and Abilene were the two they lost in a row. But otherwise, they tend to step back off of those losses pretty well. So it's going to be – I think it's a game worth watching. And then after that, you've got going to Delaware, and Delaware's got the full rest, and we'll be running short on a fourth straight road game. Tough spot. Tough, tough spot. Now, Dylan Painter was out yesterday against James Madison after he was part of the slipping injuries at the Towson Arena on Thursday. Somebody, by the way, made a Pat Kennedy's jacket reference on one of the message boards somewhere, and I was so happy that they made. I was very proud of our posters when that
it
happened.
It took me a second, but I remember that.
Yeah, throw that down and cover it. So if he's out, obviously that's a huge difference maker for Delaware. They need him, so great opportunity there if he is out. But you know, I said they could lose all four on this road trip. They got the win against JMU. That's huge. If they can win one more, we can't be too pissed off. And I think, for the folks who are talking about Zach Spiker and the coaching staff in general, like, let's remember what they inherited. Let's remember the direction this program is going. I think they're KenPom 153 right now, which is almost a high under the Spiker administration. You know, you want to see push it, but the tide is moving in the right direction.
Hey, Towson's up to 89 now. We got a top 100 team in KenPom.
Yeah, which is great. So, league's getting better, and the team's getting better. League's going to continue to get better, though. As I said, these coaches are good. So, Spiker needs to keep doing it, but I'm optimistic still about this team and its future. I just want to see this team produce to its talent level right now.
Yeah, no, believe me, and that's where I think my disappointment, like, you know, and sitting there at halftime yesterday, wow, we're up 14. What a huge win this will be if we get it. And then, you know, again, to kind of see them not be shy about how they wanted to defend us and attack us and for us to just take the blows. Believe me, I'm not selling on this team, you know, this program. I love the staff. They're very professional. They seem like they waved to us. They didn't do it on Saturday a couple times. They've seen us early. I think at Delaware one time we were there really early and he waved to us. A little thing, you know, that he appreciates people. I like his Twitter posts supporting the women and, you know, and vice versa. He seemed like he's involved in the campus. So I want Zach Spiker to win a million championships here and not go on to a bigger school. But I feel better if we're going at the coaching staff instead of players or just college kids. So we all see what we're capable of, and that's what we're kind of, we don't want to see it slip away. So that's really what it comes from.
I was half joking. Oh, sorry, Eric, go ahead.
I don't see UNCW taking it to us, and they're not quite that same kind of styles of Towson. So I'd say, you know, I think if one team lights it up from three tomorrow night, they're going to win the game. Trask has been a very tough place for Drexel. But what I'm really surprised here, you won't believe this, the line for tomorrow is UNCW by 1.5. That's it.
That's about where I thought. That's actually probably a little more generous towards the dub than I thought they would get. But I feel like that's probably right.
Yeah, and that's with, you know, with a little rest, you know, a little bit of road weariness. Kind of surprised, but, you know, we'll see. Well, that's why they play the games.
Yeah, I was joking earlier on about, you know, we only want to talk about losses. No, sports radio wants to talk about losses. It's the Facebook algorithm effect. It's the whole thing. It pisses me off. I want to be very clear. The fact that people only want to talk about losses pisses me off. But I get if you call into IP after a Flyers loss, everybody, you know, wants to talk about Giroux or something. And if you call in after a win, they want to talk about the Eagles. Right. So I do get the mentality. It's a flaw in humanity right now, is my opinion. I want to talk about the wins too here. I think they're important. I'm glad we got to cover the JMU game, but more importantly that we get to cover a very ho-hum, another road sweep by the women.
Yeah, and Eric was the first person to tell me that the Flyers won on Saturday, so appreciate you letting know that the win streak ended. But you're talking about the women?
I made the right call in that game, by the way. I said, you know, they're up 3-2, 5 minutes left. There's plenty of time for the Kings to come back and tie this game. Surely enough, with 30 seconds left, they get a goal. The Flyers miracle the way into overtime.
Well, and you're right. I Philadelphia in me was saying, man, I hope they're more entertaining if they keep losing. So, like, but now I'm glad they won. And my son's, Evan's probably out there watching the Phantoms right now. He watches every game. Once it's over, I'll find out if they won in a minute. But anyway, let's talk about the women. I'll try to be, I want to be brief, but give them the time they deserve for sure. So, and this, you know, this sets up too, and I guess this is what put me in the mood I was in on Saturday, you know, watching, you know, Towson come out in the second half and just totally take it to us, because that's what our women's team did to Elon. So we were in pretty bad shape at halftime. Let me see. So if I put down somewhere the score now, I can't remember. But if I have it right, it looks like Elon was up by as many as 10 in the first half. They were red hot to start shooting. They were 5 of 7 from 3 in the first quarter. But then they were only 1 of 14 the rest of the game. But some of our numbers too for the first half, we were only 8 of 21 in the first half, but then we were 18 of 29 for 62% in the second half. We had 10 turnovers in the first half. We had 3 in the second half, and a lot of the difference was we pressed. We came out in the second half behind, and we came after them, forced turnovers. Nyhill was all over the place doing what she does. She was probably our best player. She had 19 of her 21 points in the second half, and a lot of that had to do with her, you know, forcing turnovers and things. But Brugler had a big game. She had 20 points. So then we ended up leading in the second half by as many as 13 and outscored Elon 45-25 in the second half. So, you know, we end up taking a deficit and end up just about running away with the game. So, like I said, I was in a mindset of watching a game where a coach makes adjustments and flies out and takes a game over, and then go there Saturday and watch us let a team take it from us. It was the opposite. So, I don't know if you guys had any thoughts on the game Friday night at Elon.
Nothing specific other than, you know, nice win. I mean, Elon continues to be a really good program and one that's given this team fits over the years. So to go down to the Shar, and you're right, to respond like that, that's a lot harder to – I mean, we talk about Towson doing it, but it's a lot harder to do on the road. It's going to halftime down and come out strong and really wipe a smile off their faces. And once again, you know, they seem to have an answer for everything. Yeah. And we talk about the men, maybe we getting unlucky at times. Maybe the ball bounces, you know, creating your own luck. Whatever the case, but these women create their own luck. There's just no question.
Yeah. No. And another thing, and again, you talk about the coaching staff and the women's program. This has always been true. But yeah, I remember when Marshall was on, we talked about Tess Brugler and free throw shooting. I think she was like below 70%. And I haven't got back. I will do this at some point. But she was 6 of 6 from the line in a game. So, you know, she was, and I think she made some big free throws today too. So it was one of those. That's how you know you have a good coaching staff. You see a player, you see a weakness, and then you see them as the season goes on, they improve it. And makes her such a much better post player because she's not worried about getting to the free throw line. So anyway, that's been neat to see. So nice win Friday night. And then this afternoon, the other thing to say too, and I guess at the end of the day, I can't really say any more about this team to get people to watch them. I mean, if 13 straight wins and, you know, first place in the CAA and what, 16-2 overall, these are really exciting games, which on one hand, you're like,
you know, I always thought that they would it be good for them to lose a game? You know, do you learn more from a loss? But I'm just trying to enjoy the games because they've been really, they've been terrific games. So today we win 75-67 in two overtimes. And the way we did everything we could possibly do to lose the game. So we had 20 turnovers as a team. Nihil of Washington combined for 10. So, and Nihil in particular didn't really have her best game today. Tess Brugler only had 2 points. She got in foul trouble, so she only played 12 minutes. Mariah Leonard, it was a pretty, I haven't learned this whole flagrant one and two thing. I need to at some point. She got hammered and they didn't even look at it. But she ended up going out with an injury. She ended up coming back. So bottom line is we were out Leonard. Brugler was on the bench in foul trouble. Nihil and Washington are playing well. And still found a way to win is really what it comes down to. So a lot of that being Keyshawn of Washington, who she finished. And we'll talk, I think we'll close this on a conversation, her related to Cam, a thought I have. But she ended up scoring 13 points. And finally got to double overtime. She's like, all right, that's it. We're finishing this. And she scored 13 points, 4-4 from the field, 4-5 from the line. And then finished with a career high 40 points. So we just, and I think, again, you talk about toughness and winning on the road. You know, one thing we did well was second chance points. We outscored them 15-7 and out rebounded them 44-32. So we just gutted this one out, did everything we could to lose and found a way. So it was a great ball game and a lot of fun to watch. So,
yeah, the women scored 15 points in the second overtime, which was more points than they scored in any of the four quarters. I'm sure a lot of those were foul shots.
Yeah, not too many of them. I mean, I think she, Keyshawn, like she hit a three, and then we hit her on a drive, and she just took the game over. So, it was nice to see how she ended that. But they did, and the reason why, and I alluded on it quick, and maybe this is something to finish on. You know, we talk about Cam and great player. We all like watching him. But I compare that to Keyshawna today. You know, again, she kind of drew a line in the sand and said, hey, we're going to win this game. This game's over right now. And in Cam's defense, he hasn't really been in too many of those situations in his career. But I'd like to see that kind of game of him, you know, and not where he's asked to go 1-on-5, but you know, again, we do a good job of getting him open looks and getting him in good situations and see him just put a game away for us. I think it's going to help down the stretch. So
I do think the one piece of flaw that comp to me is that Keyshawna has Hannah, right? And defense is, there's no guard, right? They have to split between those two heavy guards. And I don't know if there's a second guard at Drexel right now. We've seen flashes from Xavier. You know, we've seen some other guys step up at times, but nobody's, you know, an all league player next to Cam, like you know, a first team all league player in the guard position next to Cam, like Keyshawna has next to her. So I'll give Cam, you know, it's just easier to key on him, I think, in my opinion. But they're both excellent players, and what Keyshawna has done has been impressive. You know, I told you guys going into this, you know, on the last podcast, Elon was telling, but then William and Mary was just trap city coming out of that game, back half of a weekend, tough place to play. And, you know, could they overcome it? And that's a really impressive 2-0 road trip. I was joking about the whole hump. I mean, it's just a really impressive 2-0. You come home now, you catch two teams, you know, in Wilmington and Charleston that you should beat at home. And you can, you know, reload a little bit. You know, should beat is always the devil, right? But they're at home, and we'll see how they do. I do want to note, it's important. They ran the table in December. And with this game at William & Mary, they've run the table in January. They didn't lose a game in January. That's 2 calendar months without losing a game. It's unheard of. It's unheard of. And that's what I'm going to wallpaper the internet with this week when we talk about the women's program, because that needs to be shouted from the rooftops. The Drexel official at the account needs to shout it. How many times has that happened in recent memory that the team isn't, you know, a top 5 team in the country in women's basketball or men's basketball? You don't see December and January undefeated anywhere. I don't care what your schedule was. It's incredibly impressive the level they're playing at right now. And, you know, games like today scare you. But my goodness. By hook or by crook, they seem to find a way every time. And it's really just, it's an impressive display. They're going to host the conference tournament. I mean, everything just lined up for them right now if they can stay healthy. So, you just have to give your hat off to that whole organization, from the managers to the players and the coaches. I mean, everybody's just doing their share, clearly, and really another impressive road trip and a really impressive month.
Yeah, I have to say, when you were talking about the William and Mary, I was just overconfidence last week. I'm like, come on. Yeah, I thought they'd win easy today. I don't want to say I was surprised that it was a tough. I guess I just like to see them just totally flatten somebody because I think they're capable of that. But I think it's a good reality check for everybody not to get too high. And I think that's where the leadership of the team is going to come in. I don't think they're going to get too carried away. So they'll keep improving. That's why I said it would have lost help them so they could go back to the drawing board and get better. But I'm sure they have the mentality, win or lose, they're just trying to get better. So, but I will say, to your other point last week, you said the schedule's been easy. I will say it will get harder now. I mean, you look at it, I mean, they go to Northeastern and I think that's going to be a hard game. And then they're at Delaware, they're at Towson. So they're tougher games at JMU, although they've been kind of weak. They're tougher games, you could argue, are ahead of them. But again, yeah, to keep putting out the wins night after night is, yeah, it's fun to watch. So, yeah, not much else to say about them, I guess. So
come home next week, flatten somebody. I agree with you. This is your opportunity. Go flatten one of these two teams. Make us feel good.
Yeah, exactly.
And then yeah, you've got a tough that Northeastern game's a Sunday, so again, second half of a road swing, that's always tough. Mm-hmm. At Delaware's gonna be tough. You can't overlook Hofstra, although that's a pretty easy game to overlook to kick off that trip. So
yeah,
I mean, get back through there, check with me, but at that point we're being mid February. At that point you're a couple weeks away from the tournament. Like if that's when you're worried about losing a game, I mean, my goodness, it's just incredible.
Yeah. So fun to watch. So, you know, anyway, but all right. Anything else you guys wanted to talk about, bring up?
No. There's no reason for me to sneak this in here, but I meant to sneak this in earlier, so I'm going to do it anyway. Coltrane Washington gets hit on a back door in the Towson game, which is the first time I think I saw them run the back door in about forever, and I just thought it was awesome. And he also went to the basket, drove to the basket, beat his man. The help never came. And put it up, and we're seeing him develop a little bit, and now it's becoming an interesting piece. He's really growing, and I'm excited to see him embracing the opportunity he's getting.
Yeah, right. I have him 14 points against James Madison, and then five of seven, and yeah, it wasn't all three. So no, yeah, those are the things. Yeah, we talk about the women's team. You see players get better. I'm with you. And he went to what? I'll be honest. What I heard, he went to some Penn State Scavalade school. I was like, what? So yeah, these are the kind of guys you like to see getting better. So, but yeah. All right. We've got nothing else. So thank you for joining us, and then we'll probably see you same time next week.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye-bye. All right.